My name is Samuel Weiss, and I've been brought in to present oral argument on behalf of the appellant, Mr. William Barker. I'd like to preserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I'd like to begin with laying out the standard for a disability law failure to accommodate claim and show where the district court erred and the state of California has erred in this appeal. For a failure to accommodate claim under Title II of the ADA or the Rehab Act, the question is whether, first, he had a disability. Here, there's no dispute about that. He was permanently disabled. Second, whether without an accommodation, he lacked meaningful access to a public entity's programs, services, or activities because of his disability. There's no question about that here either. Without an accommodation, he could not use the bathroom. And this court has squarely held in Pierce versus Orange County, as well as Armstrong versus Schwarzenegger, that the use of a toilet in a prison is a program, service, or activity. And then the final issue is whether the public entity was reasonable in accommodating his disability to provide him such access to that program, service, or activity. And
so
that's really the
whole...
Could
I ask you, say yes. We agree with you on all the things you just said. My understanding is that to get damages, he also needs to show deliberate indifference under Duval versus County of Kitsap. So that's where I'm stuck on his claim. Can you respond to that?
Absolutely. So you're correct that to obtain damages under the ADA, you must show deliberate indifference. But it's important, especially since we might get into the Eighth Amendment claim later, to distinguish between what deliberate indifference means in the ADA context versus what it means in the Eighth Amendment context. For the ADA, deliberate indifference is knowledge of a substantial likelihood of a violation of the ADA. So here, and recall that for both of the ADA claims were on a Rule 12 motion, we have two separate real failures to accommodate. One is the use of the Hoyer lift, which resulted in substantial injury to him. And second is the failure to provide him any sort of access to the toilet with some sort of a lift while he was in administrative segregation. So on both of those...
Hoyer lift, it's a little odd because we have the motion to dismiss and we also have summary judgment, so we know sort of more about this case than we would usually know, but it seems like he acknowledges that they've successfully used a Hoyer lift since this incident and there's been no problem since. And so that makes it hard to see how it was so unreasonable for them to try to use a Hoyer lift.
Right. Well, so I think, again, we are on Rule 12 here, and I think it's worth parsing the deposition testimony here, if we're going to look at the discovery. What he alleges is that he, and this is also, it's not particularly detailed in the complaint, but there's more detail in his grievances that are attached to the complaint and therefore appropriately considered on Rule 12. What he alleges is that he had been transferred using a manual lift, and that when they came in with the Hoyer lift, he said, "I have a back problem. This is going to hurt my back. Please don't do this." And argued with him, also consider the power dynamics here, right? This is a staff member to prison where he's incarcerated, that the other staff members also argued with Mr. Osamwingi about whether to use the Hoyer lift. So does this create a substantial knowledge of the public entity of a substantial likelihood of a failure to accommodate? And as an allegation, yes, I think that's pretty clear. And then also for the second set of failures to transfer, where he said, when I was in administrative segregation, I wasn't transferred at all, out of retaliation, there you also have a straightforward allegation of deliberate indifference.
So that one seems kind of conclusory and vague. I have trouble understanding how there's an adequate allegation of retaliation that cites any kind of specific failure to transfer. Can you explain how you're reading it as sufficient?
Sure. Although I think there's two separate questions. There's because I think it goes to the Title II claim as well as the Title V claim. So it shows deliberate indifference in that they it's clear from the record and his allegations that he could not get to the toilet on his own. And he's alleged that he, for retaliatory reasons, was not given the ability to transfer out of retaliation for his past complaints. So that also demonstrates deliberate indifference on a Rule 12 standard. Now, whether he has alleged a Title V claim, it's true that the complaints were vague, or they did not go into a tremendous amount of detail. But the district court's two bases for dismissal and the two arguments before us here on appeal, we think were both incorrect. So the first is the temporal issue. And the temporal issue treats Mr. Barker like he was just any other litigant. But he was incarcerated, and the Prison Litigation Reform Act has an exhaustion requirement for the exact purpose of putting defendants on notice before a plaintiff can file a lawsuit. And so, of course, defendants were aware of his potential plans to litigate, as well as his past ADA litigation. So we think the temporal issue is wrong. And then the district court also relied on this hypothetical of, well, he was, you know, in his complaint, Mr. Barker was out, wanted to be straightforward and make clear, not even allow the inference that the reason he was transferred to segregation was retaliation. He made clear that that was for a different reason, that he had a dispute with the staff member. But then once he was there, he was retaliated against. And the district court said, well, it could have been that reason as opposed to this reason. And that's totally a plausible finding for a fact finder to make. It's just not appropriate on Rule 12. And while his allegations were somewhat vague, you know, it's also the case that it's a relatively straightforward and plausible story that he was transferred in a way that he did not like. He was injured. He filed grievances and eventually a lawsuit about it. And in retaliation, the facility said, okay, you don't like how we're going to transfer you? We're not going to transfer you at all.
Are we supposed to be able to tell that what he's saying is he wasn't transferred at all? I mean, I think he says something vague, like I was denied services.
Your Honor, I think it's a little bit in paragraph 27 of the complaint. I think it's a little bit more specific than that. I could be wrong. That's on SER 25. I can actually pull it up while we're talking, if that would be helpful.
I'll look at it as well.
Yeah, paragraph 27. He was placed in administrative segregation. While in administrative segregation, Barker was denied aid from prison nursing staff with transferring himself to and from his wheelchair because of past lawsuits he filed against prison staff. And I think there's a little bit more detail in the under the heading of, you know, the Title V count. But yeah, it wasn't particularly detailed. I think in response to your concern, what we would say is please reverse that ruling and remand with instructions for the district court to grant leave to amend, because the district court dismissed without leave to amend on the grounds that there was misjoinder. But the only reason that there was misjoinder was because, and even the district court straightforwardly says this, the only reason there was misjoinder is because they had dismissed the Title II ADA claim. But we think the Title II ADA claim is pretty straightforward and should be reversed. And once the Title II ADA claim is back in the case, there's even the district court concedes that there's no misjoinder.
But so we would have to agree with you about this idea that the Hoyer lift was deliberate indifference in order for there to be a claim to hook the retaliation claim onto, right?
Well, so I think if the Title II ADA case comes back, then I think the joinder issue is straightforward and the district court has already conceded that. It says because the Title II ADA claim, that's what the district court opinion says, is out. I think even now, obviously there's no joinder issue if this is the only case you send back. But if you send just this and the Eighth Amendment claim back, which I think would be kind of curious, I think the Title II the Title II of the ADA is a broad remedial statute. It is not as high a bar as the Eighth Amendment. So I think that would be odd. I think the Title II ADA question is easier. But if you were to send the Eighth Amendment claim back, I think that there's still a strong argument that there was an abuse of discretion, that this is still in the same series of transactions. And given how liberal joinder is supposed to be against what are the same defendants or agents of the same defendant here. But I think that's a closer issue and you have to get into it. You have to get into a joinder analysis. Whereas if you send the Title II ADA claim back, it's straightforward.
Can we go back to the Title II claim and just help me understand why this is a failure to accommodate as opposed to just a negligent attempt to execute a reasonable accommodation? That's where I guess I'm having trouble.
Well, because an accommodation is not reasonable if perhaps I'll put it this way. Negligence goes to the mental state of the defendants, right? So this is a deliberate indifference question. What did Asamoah know? Well, on the allegations of the complaint, he had always been transferred using a manual lift. He was permanently disabled, and they showed up at the Hoyer lift, and despite these power dynamics, Mr. Barker said, "My back is messed up. You are going to injure me if you do that." And the other staff members argued with Asamoah and said, "You're going to injure him if you do that." And then,
that's not quite, I guess maybe I don't have the facts quite straight, but I thought rather it was if they had used it, kind of used as directed, the Hoyer lift would not have posed any risk of injury to the back. It's rather that your client said, if you use it in that way, in the way that it's supposed to be used, you're going to injure my groin area or something like that. And so they said, oh, okay, well, to accommodate that concern of yours, let's try it this other way. And that's what unfortunately led to the injury, but that's just kind of a negligent attempt to use this device that otherwise would have been fine.
Yeah, I don't think that that's clear. Certainly reading the inferences in the light that we have to on Rule 12, I would encourage the court to look at the deposition testimony that Mr. Barker cites in his opening brief. I mean, I have a little bit of it in front of me right here where Barker said, quote, "Don't do it. I don't want to be put in this Hoyer lift because it's going to hurt my back." It's hard to imagine how we could have been more straightforward than that. Defendants make this distinction on appeal where he said my back's messed up, but he didn't say he had a chronic back condition. I don't know what kind of burden we're putting on incarcerated plaintiffs when it's they don't use the exact right medical terminology in diagnosing themselves and asking for help. And what Mr. Asamoah
said. Is it an objective question? Like, so he's saying don't use this Hoyer lift, but can we assume that the prison officials knew that Hoyer lifts generally work? And in fact, we know that it generally works for him most of the time. So I don't really understand how we get to the idea that it was so unreasonable.
Well, I don't think we know. From the allegations on the complaint, I don't think we know that it worked on him later. It had not worked on him before. He was clear they had used a manual lift before. Part of the unreasonableness is, again, unreasonable isn't exactly the right term here, but was Asamoah, was he put on notice of a substantial likelihood of a violation of a federal right? And here, that was the right to a reasonable accommodation. And I think the fact that he had this argument, that the other staff members joined in his argument, and Mr. Asamoah said, "I'll either use the Hoyer lift or he can sit here and basically defecate on himself." Those are the two options. And also relevant here when it comes to their different options, nowhere in the record or in the briefing is there any explanation of why they couldn't use the manual lift. They had used the manual lift for several times.
I think there's an explanation now in the record. I mean, we do know now why they're saying they couldn't use it, and it had something to do with the size of your client and his uncooperativeness and being lifted.
Well, I think they said because of safety reasons, but
right.
Whether he had done anything, whether this is totally a post hoc rationalization cooked up by lawyers as opposed to what Mr. Asamoah's actual basis for decision, because we're looking at his mental state.
But we know that he's several hundred pounds, right? He's very heavy.
I think he's like 230 pounds. He's also permanently disabled. It's unclear why he wasn't a safety risk in the first 3 days he was there. Just a point that I would like to make, two points, I guess, I'd like to make very briefly. One is that this reasonableness question, the reasonableness of accommodation, it's black letter ADA law. This is a context-specific, fact-specific inquiry. This is usually a question for the fact finder. It's typically not even resolved on summary judgment. Here it was resolved on Rule 12. Defendants frame this as a denial question, but it's not a denial question. It's a reasonableness question. He sat on that toilet for 2.5 hours, or he sat on his wheelchair for 2.5 hours, trying not to defecate himself. There's no question about that. I'll just reserve whatever time you all would like to give me after that.
We'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. You've exceeded all of your time for your main argument, but let's turn to counsel for the defendants and hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Diana Esquivel from the Office of the Attorney General on behalf of defendants and appellees, Osamwenge and Ramaskol. And Your Honors, I was going to have my little spiel, but given that time flies, I'm going to direct some of the specific points that have been raised just so we can get some clarity in terms of the proper pleading. The correct and the operative complaint that governed the motion to dismiss. I want to discuss the motion to dismiss first of the ADA and retaliation claims. Is the second amended complaint that we submitted in the supplemental excerpts of records at pages 21 to 31. We did address this in our brief that there was a misnaming of the complaints. So we have to look at the correct complaint. Throughout the opening brief, they kept referring to the first amended complaint as the basis that why they're arguing that dismissal was improper, but they were looking at the wrong pleading. The correct pleading that the...
We have the right pleading, okay. And in fact, your opponent quoted from the right pleading. So just what's the point you want us to focus on then?
Your Honor, is that whether it's a denial or a failure to provide reasonable accommodations, the allegations in the second amended complaint are inadequate to state a cognizable claim for either one. And that was what the district court was trying to address. And in addressing the opposition that because this is a question of the adequacy of the provision, whether it's movement or whether it's treatment, et cetera, it kind of veered off course. And this is where it's our position that you really don't even have to go down that road. You just have to look at the allegations in the complaint and see how big they are, that they don't state a cognizable claim.
Okay, so let's say that we agree with you on that limited point, but what I guess I view as the stronger argument from your opponent is that, well, listen, we should have been granted leave to amend, and so that's kind of what I'm focused on. It seems like there are facts here that could be crafted into a cognizable claim, and why do you think that there's just no set of facts that could possibly be put in an amended complaint that would survive a motion to dismiss?
Because here, Your Honor, the district court exercised its discretion to, as it's permitted to under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21, to drop CDCR and the state as a party based on the fact that even if the plaintiff could properly plead an ADA and retaliation claim, it would be a misjoinder because there was no facts to show a relationship between what happened in March of 2015 when the Hoyer lift was used and almost 2 years later when he was transferred to administrative segregation.
I thought we were talking about the Title II claim. you've shifted now to the basis for dismissing the Title V claim. I want to focus on the Title II claim.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that I think I agree with you that as the claim is pleaded in the complaint that you directed us to, yeah, it's probably not adequate. But it was dismissed without leave to amend, ultimately, right? And it just seems to me that was wrong, that there should have been leave to amend should have been granted. And I guess I just wanted to hear your response to that point as to the Title II claim.
So I apologize, Your Honor. I took them both in my mind. So I'll separate those two. That, again, because the 1983 claim could stand on its own, again, the judge is looking, what's the more efficient way to deal with these allegations against the state and the department? So if they're seeking an ADA claim, which cannot be brought against the two individual defendants, the court here, they're already on their third complaint. This is not a pro se litigant that's drafting his own complaint. This is very knowledgeable and skilled attorney that specialized in ADA claims that filed the first and second amended complaints, that they're not putting forth sufficient facts to state a cognizable claim. So again, the court, using its discretion, can say, okay, we'll grant leave to amend, or under Rule 21 can say, since there's no evidence that they're connected, we can drop them and proceed with the action on the 1983 claim. And then, as we mentioned, if plaintiff had then proceeded to file a separate action correcting the ADA, they could have subsequently made a motion to consolidate or have the cases related if they were able to make that factual connection so that it becomes a permissible joinder under Rule 20. But plaintiff chose to let the statute of limitations lapse and not proceed to try to see if they can make a cognizable claim under the ADA or for retaliation under the ADA.
I will confess.
So if you look at the court's discretion, that's the real question here. Did the court abuse its discretion in choosing this approach as opposed to keeping the claims together or the parties together and deciding it's probably more efficient for us to let us proceed on the 1983. They've already had several opportunities to amend the complaint. They haven't shown sufficient facts and chose to go the other route.
So your answer, I guess, although what you just not very little of what you just said seemed responsive to the question I posed to you, but as to the Title II claim, I gather your answer is just simply that they had enough chances and time had run out, and so the district court was correct in just saying you've blown the two chances I gave you, and that's it. You're not getting another one. Is that's it at the end of the day? That's
well,
your answer.
I'm not saying, Your Honor. I'm not saying it's that. That's obviously one of the considerations. I'm not saying it's the only consideration, but the court then started looking at it from the perspective of what is the accommodation claim that plaintiff is trying to allege based on the complaint, based on what was raised in the opposing papers. And the court concluded that where plaintiff was headed with this argument was that Mr. Barker was complaining more about the manner in which he was the Hoyer list was used, rather than the fact that it was a denial, because even the allegations don't really show that it was an improper accommodation, because they were trying to accommodate him. The question was the manner in which they used. So for the district judge, it became a question of, is this really an accommodations questions, denial questions, or are they mixing it with what would be improper treatment or manner of movement? So because plaintiffs, again, had not provided the factual basis to make that distinction given the very vague allegations.
Okay. Can I ask you?
I would just say at this point, is it an abuse of discretion to say after three attempts to properly plead an ADA claim under Title II, is that enough or is that not enough? Again, it's the district judge sitting, looking at what's been filed, looking at all the pleadings that have been submitted to that point, looking at all the argument of counsel, and then making that determination and exercising its discretion to decide, I think this is better suited.
Ask you a different question. Can I ask you a different question on a different subject now? As to the deliberate indifference standard, do you agree with what your opponent said, that it's the standard is not the same for the Eighth Amendment and for a Title II money damages claim?
I do not agree with that. I agree the deliberate standard always requires that there be information and not notice, information available to the party from which he or she can reasonably infer that acting in a particular manner creates a substantial risk of serious harm to the prisoner. And that is applicable under both the ADA and the Eighth Amendment. It's the creation of a substantial risk of serious harm by taking a particular action.
You think that's what we said in Duval as to what deliberate indifference means in the Title II context?
I'm sorry?
I'm talking about Duval, which is the case in which we finally said that deliberate indifference can work. I guess I just read that case differently, I think, from what you just described. It does seem to state a standard that's distinct from the Eighth Amendment standard because it's focused on whether the person has notice that their actions are going to result in the denial of the person's rights under the ADA, not having anything to do with, you know, inflicting deliberate infliction of pain.
Well, if are we speaking in terms of and for purposes of the dismissal motion, or are we talking in terms of the motion for summary? I'm sorry, I guess I must have.
Fair enough. I guess let me put it in more blunt terms. Given that we now have the summary judgment record on the Eighth Amendment claim, I suppose one could argue that, well, there's really no point in allowing this Title II claim to go forward because we know ultimately he's not going to be able to prove deliberate indifference. That's at least one argument one could make. Your opponent says, well, no, we can't rely on the summary judgment record as to the Eighth Amendment claim and the fact that, you know, even if we were to affirm the dismissal of that claim, that would not bar the Title II claim from going forward because the standard for deliberate indifference under Title II is different from the standard under the Eighth Amendment. And so I was just trying to get you to respond. It seemed to me that he seems right on that point, that the standards are different, and I was trying to get your response on that legal point.
Your Honor, that the standard for an Eighth Amendment claim is higher, such that the looser standard under the ADA would be satisfied if you can show that deliberate indifference there's no triable issue of fact as to deliberate indifference under the Eighth Amendment standard. The evidence that we presented on the summary judgment motion not only shows that Mr. Barker was using the Hoyer lift before he arrived at the healthcare facility center, but also used it afterwards. And that morning, when on March 5th, I believe, 2015, before he was injured, he met with a nurse to discuss his complaint that he didn't want the Hoyer lift to continue to be used. But that nurse explained to him, that supervising nurse explained to him, and this is all in the record, that given his weight, he created a risk for both himself and for staff because staff might drop him if they were to do a manual labor. We submitted the declaration of a nursing expert who provided testimony that even if the defendants had performed a manual lift There was no guarantee that his back would hurt because the manner in which the Hoyer lift was used paralleled the mechanics of a manual lift. So based on all the evidence that is already in the record in terms of the use and the reason why it was used, the reasonableness of the manner in which it was used, and that there was no medical contraindication to use the Hoyer lift, that now makes it futile to remand this case, even on the ADA claim, if we're talking just about notice and reasonableness, because all the evidence already satisfies those factors.
Okay, thank you.
And unless your honors have any other questions, I'm almost out of time. The other issue I would point out in terms of some of the evidentiary objections is that the manual, in terms of how to use the lift, that one, even though the district court sustained the objection, it itself even spoke to using the Hoyer lift in the manner in which it was used, and we cite that specifically, and we point that out in our brief, that the manufacturer of that specific Hoyer lift said that it could be used with the straps underneath the arms to bring an individual to a standing position, as opposed to lifting him, his entire body, and transferring him to another location.
Okay.
So unless your honors have any other questions, I'll go ahead and submit.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Let's put 2 minutes on the clock for rebuttal, please. Oh, that's fine. Okay.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, yeah.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. And
I do have a question. So is there an objective component to the deliberate indifference that applies under Title II?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the deliberate indifference, my friend on the other side, I think, summarized deliberate indifference correctly, except for that in the Eighth Amendment, it's a substantial risk of serious harm. And in the ADA, it's a substantial risk of a federal right.
I'm still not sure how you get over the objective part then, especially, I mean, basically on a futility argument like Judge Watford was laying out. Like, now that we know more because of the summary judgment record, what is the point of amending? How are you ever going to get past the objective?
Well, I think it's hard to say because plaintiff's attorney here did not do discovery on the ADA claim. They only did on the Eighth Amendment claim. So for example, Judge Friedland, you asked me questions about, well, wasn't so vague and conclusory these other times where they weren't transferring him at all. We have no evidence of that because that doesn't bear on the Eighth Amendment claim. So these are the sorts of things that could have been pursued in discovery. And just a quick note on an amendment.
But are you saying that you would use the administrative segregation allegations to bolster the Title II claim?
Yeah, I think they're part of the Title II ADA claim also.
But that's not how the current complaint is, right? Or am I forgetting?
The administrative segregation is only cited in any of the counts under retaliation, but it is in our briefing, and it's also listed as a general allegation. So it's general allegation 27. So, and of course, it's the identical allegation, or close to identical. It's, once again, he was not provided a reasonable accommodation to transfer from his wheelchair to the toilet. And on that point, I would just reiterate that this court has repeatedly held its black letter ADA law in the circuit that that reasonableness is a very fact-specific, context-specific inquiry. I understand that some of the summary judgment evidence, which was not focused on the ADA claim but was focused on the Eighth Amendment claim, might cast some doubt on that. Defendant is also relying on evidence that they themselves argue is inadmissible to point to that. But on the allegations of the complaint, where you have both he and other staff members explicitly told Mr. Osamwingi, this is going to injure me, and then it did injure him, that certainly gets over the very low Rule 12 threshold to allege a Title II ADA claim.
Okay, very good. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case just argued is submitted.